This is Radio Times. I'm Artie Moss-Cohen. Norman Lear reinvented television back in the 1970s with his groundbreaking and hit programs, All in the Family, Maude, The Jeffersons, Sanford and Son, among others. He tackled controversial issues with humor and through his memorable characters, including Archie Bunker, famous for his clueless bigotry. Norman Lear says in his new memoir, Even This I Get to Experience, that his father was the model for Bunker. Lear writes about his difficult parents, his combat missions during World War II, his years in the entertainment business fighting with the networks and Carol O'Connor, who played Archie Bunker, and his long-standing interest in social issues. Norman Lear joins us here in our Philadelphia studio. A great pleasure. Nice to have you with us on Radio Times.
Thank you. I love being here.
Well, we love having you here. And I said the name of your book, Even This I Get to Experience, but I want you to say the name of your book because I want to know how you say those words.
Thinking about this broadcast, coming to Philadelphia this morning, meeting you, even this I get to experience.
All right. So it's a happy statement.
It's a very happy statement.
You write that writing this book, you had to get through this quote-unquote Everest of denial. And this was, I think, your wife told you that it was time to write this book, but it was a difficult process for you.
It was a very difficult project. For me, it's difficult being a human being, any human being. I mean, no matter the circumstances of birth, some have it far harder than others, obviously. But it's hard. It's hard growing up. It's hard. I think of it this way often. The horizontal journey in which you we're all engaged, in which we learn this and that and the other thing. We learn the chemistry. We learn geography. We learn history. Can't match the vertical journey into oneself, learning just who the hell we are.
And is that what this book did for you? I mean, it sounds like it's not like you didn't know yourself, but this took you pretty deep.
Well, I knew myself and didn't know myself at all at the same time, and it took me as deep as I could get.
Let me read the very first sentence from your preface. You said, you write, when I was a boy, I thought if I could turn a screw in my father's head just a 16th of an inch one way or the other, it might help him to tell the difference between right and wrong. I couldn't, of course, and ultimately he and I had to pay a serious price for his confusion. Your father, Herman, who called
Herman
him
King, Herman K.
Herman K, like King Lear, right?
Yes, everybody called him H.K.
H.K. I mean, he was, how would you describe your dad?
He was the word that rushes to mind, and I can't give up, is he was a rascal. But within his rascaldom, to coin a phrase, he cheated, he stole, he went to prison because he stole. It's very hard for me to say all that, but he was a liar and a cheat with a glorious zest for life. And the umbrella tag for him in my heart and mind is he was a rascal.
A rascal, which is, I mean, a rascal is more benign, shall we say, than a liar and a cheat.
And that's exactly why my heart chooses it.
Well, as you said, you were, about 9 years old, and your dad goes to prison for 3 years.
I was 9 years old. He was going. He was flying. Nobody flew then except Lindy. He was flying to Oklahoma, some transaction taking place there, and he was going to bring me back a 10-gallon hat, just like my favorite cowboy hero Ken Maynard wore. And he was arrested instead as he stepped off the plane coming back from Tulsa. He didn't have a hat with him. And that night, that very night, the papers were strewn around the house, and he was on the front page with his own hat covering his face as he was manacled to a detective. And my mother was selling the furniture. We were moving. I mean, it just was a 9-year-old nightmare.
Yeah, and you even have a scene where you're watching this, and one of your relatives says, "Now you're the man of the house, but cry."
I love that. I think I say in the book that's where I thought I began to understand the foolishness of the human condition. That this guy puts his hand. I mean, I'm holding a cloth. I was supposed to go to camp in a few weeks. So my mother had this Norman M. Lear, Norman M. Lear, Norman M. Lear that she was going to sew into my clothing. When I went away, I went away to camp, and this fool in that condition, this kid in that condition, he puts his hand on my shoulder and says, "You're the man of the house now." Yeah. I wanted to whip him.
Yeah. You went to live with relatives for a couple of years. I mean, it sounds like the family kind of scattered until your dad came back home from prison.
Yes, I lived with an uncle, and finally with my grandparents, my mother's parents.
You describe meeting your father. I guess you're on a train. He gets back, and he says, "You know, for your bar mitzvah, I'm going to take you and the family. We're going to go around the world." Did he live? I mean, fantasizing
I love that you singled that out because it's such a key to him. We're sitting on the train. He sits with my mother for a while. I'm with my sister. Then we switch around. He's finally sitting with me. And we're talking about this, that, or the other thing. And then suddenly he says, "You're going to be bar mitzvah next year. For your bar mitzvah, I'm going to take you and your mother and your sister for a trip around the world. We'll be gone a year." And that was my mantra.
Yeah. Did you believe him?
I believed him totally. Mm-hmm. I believed him. The situation was that we were going to New York to live with other people until he found a job and could afford his own apartment. And in that condition, the man says, and I believe he believed, that in a year we're going to take a trip around the world and we'll be gone a year.
Of course it didn't happen.
Right. It was the middle of the Depression. A year later, he was as broke as he was when he got out of prison.
You also say an interesting thing about him is that he, as you said, he had a big personality, but he treated everybody the same, which I thought was
interesting. Oh, you really read the book.
I really read the book. No, I did. But I found, and I'm always interested in where people came from and their parents and their growing up and their childhood and families. But the idea, especially if you're the child of someone who treats everybody the same, you kind of feel like you're not special.
Yeah, he had no sense that this fellow might be smarter than him in any way, or somebody else may be weaker and needs to be tended to a little differently. One of my favorite stories is a friend graduates from accountancy school and opens an office in accounting. And my father, whose hat, the brim of whose hat was his office, you know, he had slips of paper in the hat band. That was kind of his desk in his office. He's arguing about some very serious matter having to do with accounting with a young man, brilliant young man, just out of college with his accounting degree.
That was your dad.
That was my dad.
To go on, you call your mom, Jeanette, a world-class narcissist.
She was the best.
At being a narcissist?
The best narcissist in the history of narcissism.
Really? Her picture's in the encyclopedia?
Yes, you'll find her everywhere. But a lot of people had this mother, I have since learned.
How did her narcissism express itself? I mean, there's so many anecdotes in here of her.
Well, I was always 9 years old. When she was talking about me, I never grew older than when we lived in New York up to the age my father went away. And she would talk about the Norman who used to fall down the stairs to get a laugh. And maybe I did that once, but she held on to that. She never talked about the Norman who did this television show or that television show. I was always a kid as she described loving me. She described loving me. Never told me to my face.
Do you think she
my first big success, huge success, was the Dean Martin and Jerry Lewis Colgate Comedy Hour. The four of us kind of went into television together. They the stars, we the writers. And I called her as the credits were rolling and the show wasn't quite over. I'm on the phone in a phone booth off stage calling my mother at 68 Woodstock Street, Hartford. And the first question, I expect her to burst out with something. And the first thing she says is, "How did it go, darling?" Mm. And when I said, but didn't you say, of course, did the boys like it? Meaning Dean and Cherry.
Not you.
I don't know if ever in that conversation she said, I laughed.
Do you feel, I mean, it's interesting, as you said, you were 68, knowing this, your mother, the way you did, but hoping that this might be the time that she would recognize you, acknowledge you.
When the Hall of Fame story?
Yeah.
I mean, yeah. A good friend who was running the Academy of Television Arts and Sciences called me early on a Sunday morning to tell me they had met on Saturday and the Academy was going to start a Hall of Fame. And they had decided on the first inductees. And they were going to be the guy who invented CBS, the guy who invented NBC, the best correspondent in the history of television, Edward R. Murrow, Patty Chayefsky, the best writer, Lucille Ball, Milton Berle, and you, Norman. I was going to be in that pantheon. I called my mother as quickly as I could in Bridgeport. By then, she had remarried and my father had passed. And I told her, and she said, listen, if that's what they want to do, who am I to say?
Oh, gosh. You did, though. I guess it was her mother, Bubby. I mean, yes. As you describe her, she was someone who had a sense of humor perhaps only you observed or saw, but that she was loving and expressive, and it seems like someone who was important to you as a little boy growing up.
She was every inch and ounce of her was about love. And she didn't talk a lot. She listened. But you could see in her reactions everything you needed to know about
really?
What the other guy was saying.
Did she teach you about humor?
I think without a word of instruction, her essence taught me everything I didn't know that needed to know.
We're almost up in a break here, but were you a funny kid?
My mother tells me I was funny falling downstairs.
But besides that?
Besides that, when I got to high school, I wrote the humor column. Notes to You from King Lear.
Oh, interesting.
Stole it from HK.
Yeah, from your dad. So you were a funny writer. Did you have teachers that saw that in your writing?
There were two teachers in my mind. One was a Melvin Crowell in high school. He taught literature and journalism or literature. And the other was when I was 10 years old, 11 years old, living with my grandparents. There was a Miss Nevins. And to this day, I love Kirk Douglas because his dimple in the chin reminds me of Miss Nevins.
Pretty nice. Well, let's take a very short break, and then we'll get back to our conversation with Norman Lear. He's written a memoir called Even This I Get to Experience. We're going to take a very short break, get back to our conversation, and we have some clips from some of his more famous TV shows that we're going to be playing coming up on Radio Times. You can also join the conversation. That phone number is 1-888-477-9499. Stay with us. We'll be right back.
Supporting WHYY, Penn Medicine, helping to find new cures for cancer. With life-saving clinical trials and advanced surgical techniques, Penn Medicine is offering more hope for patients everywhere. Learn more at PennMedicine.org/cancer. Penn Medicine, what's next?
This is Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moss-Cohen talking with Norman Lear about his new memoir, Even This I Get to Experience. And he's the creator of many well-known programs back in the 1970s, All in the Family, The Jeffersons, Maude, Sanford and Son. We're going to be playing clips from some of those programs and also taking calls at 1-888-477-9499. I do want to jump forward to your time in television. And you were interested in this British comedy, Till Death Do Us Part, the idea of turning that into a show for Americans.
It was introduced to me by a woman by the name of Beryl Virtue. She was an agent at the time, I think still functioning in London. I had called her because I read about this show, a simple line in TV Guide.
About a father and a son.
About a father and son who had the relationship that Archie and that was me. That was my father. I was the laziest white kid he ever met.
And that's what your father would say to you,
would
right?
My father, yeah. And when I would bawl him out for putting a race of people down to call me lazy, wasn't what he was doing, and I was the dumbest white kid he ever met.
So that was the sort of genesis then of
yeah, we,
of all
we
in the
argued
family.
About everything. And as soon as I heard about, read about this, I thought, how did I not think of this before?
So how did you, I know it was a big, a struggle to get it on TV, to say the least.
To say the least. It took three, I made it originally for ABC. There were only three networks at the time. ABC bought it originally, made the same script exactly that I made 3 years plus some months later. Didn't change a word because I used to say, we're going to jump into the water. You can't get wetter than wet.
Mm-hmm.
And we're going to get wet with Archie. We're going to know 360 degrees of the man. So it was the same script. They wouldn't make it the first year. They caused me, they had the right to pick it up for a year.
This is ABC.
ABC, and make it again. And so I did it twice before they lost it. And then somebody, Robert Wood, came on as a new president of CBS. He looked at the show and wanted it.
And as you say, Archie, in a sense, is it an homage to your father? I mean, is it a sort of a tribute to your dad, or it's taking your father and putting him out there for us to look at?
No. He was a kickoff. My father was a kickoff. Then the game played out 4 quarters. And Archie was all 4 quarters, not just the kickoff.
I do want to play a clip from All in the Family, but even before we get to that, so how did you see Archie Bunker?
I saw Archie Bunker as afraid of tomorrow, afraid of what tomorrow would bring, afraid of progress. So long as he was doing well, he was holding on and clutching the present, not moving into the future. In a way, I guess that was my, I'm thinking this perhaps for the first time, that was my dad too. What he thought of himself in the moment he thought it represented, he never learned anything. Mm. He never moved forward. That was it.
Because, and we're going to play this clip, and I think some people might be very offended by what they hear. Do you think of him as a racist?
I'm sorry, as a?
Racist, a bigot? Archie Bunker?
Yes, he was, but I look for reasons behind that. And there were other things that were playing into it, like the fear of tomorrow.
Right.
What? Black people moving next door? I don't know black people. I've never been with black people. They're not, that's the way the culture has treated my part of the city and black people.
Well, I do want to play this scene, and again, this is from All in the Family, and Archie Bunker and his son, Michael, calls Meathead, are locked in a basement together. Actually, it's his son-in-law, Michael, are locked in a basement together. They're actually drunk, and they are talking about their fathers. Of course, Carol O'Connor, who plays Archie Bunker, and Rob Reiner playing Michael. Let's listen.
Kids all made funny, huh?
Yeah, they all made fun. Well, all except one little black kid by the name of Winston.
A black kid liked you?
No, the black kid beat the hell out of me.
Why?
I don't know, not much.
Well, he must have had a reason.
Well, he said that I said he was a nigger.
Well, did you?
Sure.
Well, then that was the reason.
What the hell reason was that? That's what all them people was calling them days. I mean, everybody we knew called them people niggas. That's all my old man ever called them there. What the hell was I supposed to call them? I didn't know that they were. I should call them a wop. I couldn't call them wops because wop was what we call a dagos.
Did you ever think that possibly your father just might be wrong?
Wrong, my old man? Don't be stupid, my old man. Let me tell you about him. He was never wrong about nothing.
Yes, he was, Arch. My old man used to call people the same things as your old man. But I always knew he was wrong. So was your old man.
No, he was.
Yes, he was.
He was.
Your father was wrong.
Zaps!
Your father was wrong!
Don't tell me my father was wrong.
That's one heck of a scene, Norman Lear. There, wow. You're listening to it. First of all, it's rough stuff. There's language, you know, we don't hear certainly on broadcast television today. But on you wanted him to say the N word, if I can say that.
Yes, it wasn't anything that wasn't heard in the schoolyard anywhere across the country. It wasn't. The network made it what it was. The American people didn't react that way. They heard it the way it was intended. My father went on to say in that when he was talking about his father,
yes.
When he said, a man who goes out every morning of his life to work his heart out, to come back with the means to live, or you know, something to that effect. And as I'm just listening to this all these years later, right, clearly feel what I felt as a kid, because my mother, who, as we talked about, as a narcissist, had as much interest in him as she had in me. She was just involved with herself. So he would come home from what I considered, I didn't know what the hell he was doing, but it seemed like a hard day's work, or I thought of it as a hard day's work, bringing back foodstuffs that she needed, left a note for him in the morning or something, or cleaning and dyeing. And he brought back something all the time. And I hated that for him.
What he used to say to your mom, and Archie says this to Edith, stifle.
Yes.
Stifle.
Jeanette, stifle.
Was this a hard episode, or how did the network feel about a scene like that?
They didn't have a problem with a scene like that at all. By then, those words had been used, so it wasn't the words in the scene. I mean, the network never had problems with anything truly wonderful. It was silly stuff.
Oh, the silly stuff that yes. they would glom onto. It's weird to hear the laugh track, because it's, you know.
You didn't hear a laugh track. No laugh track ever. That was 250 live people sitting in that audience. We used something to cover cuts, or if we had to go back and repeat something, but never a laugh track.
I take that back, because obviously those are real people, and they're laughing. And as I was listening to this, and I was listening to this yesterday, I was uncomfortable. You know, it was hard to know where was the laugh line in there.
Well, the great thing about this was theater. I thought of it as theater, so we very rarely cut in a scene. A scene took place in full time in front of that live audience, and the actors ride the laughter and the reaction and the feelings of that audience, and that's a whole different experience than four cameras and a laugh track. Where the people inventing it, and I don't have a problem with it, it's another way to do it,
right?
Are managing the laughs, not, you know, recognizing and writing, as I like to think of it, on the laughs.
I imagine there were some members of the audience that totally identified with Archie Bunker and totally identified with his ideas, especially about black people.
But you know, the only letters, and we got a lot of letters, the only letters I ever received saying right on Archie never failed to say something negative about the people who were making the show.
Oh, interesting.
You know, if they knew I was Jewish, they would say, go back to where you came from, you dirty kike or something. They would say what Archie might say. But never was there a letter praising him that didn't altogether hate us for making it. So they got it.
Kind of a mixed message there. You write in this book about the difficulties you had with Carol O'Connor, who played Archie Bunker, and perhaps even the difficulties he had with the scripts, with the storylines, with the language. I mean, it seemed like it was just a constant battle with him over his part.
Yes. I think it stemmed for two reasons. One, he's not the only actor that was fearful getting before representing something for a live audience. And what he represented was 180 degrees from the Irish intellect that Carol O'Connor was. So all of that, plus the fact that he was playing a bigot, which he wished to play. He had no problem playing. But he had to have some sense of responsibility, you know. Anyway, there was enough reason for him to be concerned about what he was doing, legitimately. But that I couldn't let that concern make the decisions when there was disagreement. He helped every scene he ever played. He was the best writer for the dialogue we could imagine, because the way things poured out of his face was better than anything, the dialogue we wrote. Have I got time to tell you a specific?
Sure, please do.
One story involved him entering an elevator on a high floor. In that elevator was a middle-aged black guy with a with a copy of the New York Times. Archie was holding the New York Daily News. I hope the Daily News and the New York Times, should they hear this, think it's funny. It was funny at the time. And the elevator stopped, and then a Latino couple got in. She was going to have a baby, due to have a baby. She had seen her doctor. The elevator got stuck a floor or two later, and the woman panicked, and she was going to have her baby. And all of this in a tiny elevator was anathema to a fearful Carol O'Connor. He just wouldn't do it. That was the biggest fight we ever had. Wow. It called for attorneys. It called for, I will not, I won't. The CBS said, it's all over for the show. I mean, we went through all of that. And then finally, Archie, on Wednesday, we started rehearsal on Monday. On Wednesday, finally stepped into the role. And that the sound of that baby being born on the New York Times.
born on the New York Times paper,
on
right?
On the floor of that elevator, the camera on his face.
On his face.
Oh, man. It was just one of the great moments.
And he resisted. He just said, This can't happen. It just
it
didn't
can't feel- happen. Five people in an elevator, you know, for a half an hour, and the birth of a baby, and you know, I assured him the camera had no interest in seeing a baby born except on his face.
And that's Norman Lear, our guest on Radio Times. We've been talking about All in the Family, a hit show from the 1970s he created. He's also written a book called Even This I Get to Experience. If you want to join our conversation, that phone number is 1-888-477-9499. You can send us an email, radiotimes@whyy.org, and you can send us a tweet at Marty Moss Cohen, and you're listening to Radio Times here on WHYY. I do want to talk a bit about Maud, also a groundbreaking program. Where did that idea come from?
It came from All in the Family, actually. I wanted somebody who could really let Archie have it, who could bring it up from below the floor, as I used to think of it. And being a member of my family taught me that, you know, a relative with an old grudge, there's nothing like a relative with an old grudge.
Yes,
so true. We wrote a friend of Edith's who had loved her and was loved in return. They were great friends as kids and cousins, and who hated Archie when they met and never wanted her to marry him. So she came to the show with that amount of weight. And I had fallen in love with B. Arthur many, many years before, and I had brought her to California when I did the George Gobel show, which was a variety show, sketches, and brought her a number of times to California to do that. So I had a working relationship with her, and I called her. And the only thing I remember telling her was, you know, the role is so good, and she was so spectacular. There could be a series from this. And she wasn't sure she wanted to do a series when she came out to play the single role in All in the Family. But the show wasn't off the air. The single episode of Family wasn't off the air in New York before the executive, Fred Silverman, was calling me saying, there's a show on that woman.
Oh, interesting, interesting. And this was the beginning of the feminist movement, or the sort of middle of the feminist movement. She spoke to the new woman, if I can say, in a way.
She did. She did. And as a matter of fact, and I don't, it's in the book, but I don't think I've ever said it aloud to, when Archie won, when Carol O'Connor wanted to do Archie Bunker's Place, continue after the rest of us had said we were finished and there'd be no more All in the Family. Ultimately, there were a lot of back and forth, but the only way ultimately I would let it go, because I thought it was entirely doable, was for the network to donate $500,000. I think I probably wanted more, but we settled for $500,000 to NOW, the National Organization for Women.
Ah, interesting. Interesting. There was one point in your career where you had something like 7 or 9 shows on simultaneously, I mean, within a season or within a year?
Yes, yeah. 9.
9.
And 5
has that
of them,
ever been?
And 5 of them, I don't know, is in that year, but 5 out of 10 were in the top 9. Mm-hmm.
Has anyone ever come close to those numbers that you know?
I don't know, truly. I don't know that anybody had that many shows. And that happened not because I was able to do it so much as the climate demanded.
This was the 70s.
I was growing up in that. This idea seemed like a good idea. We did it. Because when I wanted to replace myself, I couldn't find the person who would take the job. And I would never have taken the job had I been offered. But when you grow up, you know, the climate suggests you better have a broom handy, you find a broom.
Norman Lear, our guest in this hour of Radio Times. And we're going to take a very short break. I do want to play a scene from Maude after we get back from this short break. And again, his book is called Even This I Get to Experience. Stay with us. We'll be right back.
Supporting WHYY, Penn Medicine, helping to find new cures for cancer. With life-saving clinical trials and advanced surgical techniques, Penn Medicine is offering more hope for patients everywhere. Learn more at PennMedicine.org/cancer. Penn Medicine, what's next?
This is Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia back in the 1970s. If you were watching TV, chances are you were watching one of Norman Lear's hit shows, whether it was All in the Family or Maude or The Jeffersons or Sanford and Son or some of the others. He tackled controversial topics through his memorable characters. He was on Nixon's enemies list, also called the number one enemy of the American family by the religious right. And he writes about all of this in his new book, his memoir, called Even This I Get to Experience. We've been talking about Maude, a program that also had had some controversy and certainly had a following. And I do want to play this scene where Maude has an abortion. And this is November 1972, so it's a couple of months before Roe v. Wade. She's 47 years old and, to her dismay, finds out that she is pregnant unexpectedly. She's talking with her husband, Walter, and Maude, of course, played by Bea Arthur. Her husband, Walter, played by Bill Macy. Let's listen.
I think it would be wrong to have a child at our age.
Oh, so do I, Walter.
Oh, Walter, so do I.
We'd make awful parents.
Oh, impatient, irascible.
Awful. It's just not our time of life.
For other people, it might be fine, but for us, I don't think it would be fair to anybody. Oh, Walter, hold me closer.
Are you frightened, Maude? About the operation, I mean.
Oh, don't be ridiculous, darling. Why should I be frightened? Were you frightened of the vasectomy?
I said, were you frightened about the vasectomy? I didn't have it. You see, I was psychologically unprepared. You can ask Arthur. Uh-huh. Arthur's a doctor.
Honey,
he told me that...
It's all right. It's all right. Just tell me, Walter, that I'm doing the right thing.
not having the baby.
For you, Maud, for me. In the privacy of our own lives, you're doing the right thing.
I love you, Walter Finley.
And again, that's a scene from Maud.
In the privacy of our own lives.
Well, I was wondering, why did you want to write that? And I hope I'm not embarrassing you here, but I see a tear coming out of your eye.
Yeah.
Is that listening to B. Arthur?
It's listening to that moment.
To that moment.
Thinking about the struggles that go on, and for no good reason that I know, in the privacy of their own lives, there it rests.
And it, was that the, I mean, I know that you didn't think of these as message shows, but was that a message you were trying to send to the audience?
We were expressing something, yes. I mean, you know, we were a group of men and women with kids and, you know, of all stripes and sizes, weights and braces. And we were bringing in the material that was, you know, impacting our lives. And this was certainly an issue of, you know, great consequence. The religious right was carrying as they on today, as they do today. And, I guess in the privacy of our own lives sums up the whole issue for me. I didn't remember that at all, but hearing it now, I couldn't help but feel it.
Was there pushback from the audience that you know of to this scene?
No, you know, when the pushback came, there was no pushback. There was, of course, there were some letters written and so forth. But by the time this was, let's say, done on the air in January, by the time May came around and the rerun was due, the religious right was armed. They did everything, including lie down in front of Mr. Paley's, the guy who...
CBS
in New York, in my car in L.A., and they wrote tons of letters. But the American... That didn't represent for me the American people.
Jerry Falwell said, I guess, about you or perhaps some of the shows that you were doing, that you were bringing filth and sexual perversions into the American living room.
Well, if that discussion between Walter and Maud is filth and perversion, I guess I have to stand up to it.
In fact, you started People for the American Way, it sounds like, in response to criticisms like that or criticisms
yes.
from the religious right.
I didn't so much start an organization as I put an ad on. I made a PSA, a public service announcement, in which a factory worker says that he and his wife and his kids sit around the table. They disagree on political matters all the time. But now there are preachers saying that you are a good Christian or a bad Christian, depending on your political point of view, which made his wife a bad Christian and one of his kids a bad Christian. And he was a great Christian all the way because he believed in all that. And he wound up saying, so there's got to be something wrong when anybody tells you, even a minister, that you're a great Christian or a bad one, depending on your political point of view. That's not the American way. And somebody, I showed it to Father Hesburgh at Notre Dame before I showed it to anybody else. And he, I'll never forget his words, he said, mainline church leaders will love this, they applaud this. But we also care about something else you may not be thinking about, and that is how the other side tortures Scripture. Could never forget that phrase, tortures Scripture. And he gave me some names of other mainline church leaders to see. And in somebody's office, they said, this should be institutionalized. And to this day, I don't wake up that many mornings, read my newspaper, and not thank God. The organization is there.
Mm. You also made it to Nixon's enemies list. What did you do to anger the President of the United States?
I probably was parked. My car was parked at a party that was taking place in a house that his FBI was watching carefully, or, you know, something like that. Uh-huh. But he also had a lot to say about Archie Bunker. When they transcribed his, those Nixon tapes from the Oval Office.
So he watched All in
well,
the Family, obviously.
He watched All in the Family, or at least seen enough of an episode to say, They're making, you know, a faggot, I think he used the word, of a good man. He was a little mixed up.
We have an email from Cindy saying, wow, so great to hear Norman Lear. As a kid growing up in the 70s, Archie Bunker represented what I really objected to and looked down on, and the show was usually hilarious. Now, being a bit older and wiser, I see that Archie's character was written so that we would see his humanity shine through. The bigot actually has a heart, and from that point of view, we can have a conversation about those issues.
Love that woman.
That's Cindy. But is that what you were trying to do?
Yeah. I have to say yes, not because I remember, but because that's who I am. Yeah. I mean, I go with that.
Let me get, looks like Josh joining us from Conshohocken. Josh, go ahead. You're on Radio Times.
Thank you so much.
You're welcome.
I just want to first say thank you to Mr. Lear. It is such a privilege to be able to say that to you because... I'm 40 years old, so I'm a kid of the 70s and 80s, and I would say, without any question, I don't think that there's any single person that had more of an impact on American social thought than you for my generation. When I think back on the fact that you gave voice, you gave context, you gave a way of talking about things that were and still remain so difficult to discuss. And I guess my question is, to you is twofold. I mean, I could talk to you all day, but my two questions.
Can't do that.
I could listen to you all day.
My question.
Go ahead, Josh.
At the time you were writing, did you realize the magnitude of the power that you had of your voice, and the extent, the level of the influence that you were having on the culture and that you would have pretty much forever? Did you realize the extent of it at that time? And today, looking back, do you have a sense of that? And how did you handle that at the time? How did you deal with that sense of responsibility for having such a massive impact on American culture?
Josh,
at the time.
Sure, Josh. Thanks for the call to Radio Times. Norman Lear, go ahead.
I wasn't aware of that impact as I have become, and some of it, What I came to understand and believe, and it thrills me, is that families turned off the show and talked. It caused them to talk about the problems the show was dealing with. And that's the ripple you get when you throw the rock in the water and you don't see the water rise. All you get is the ripple. That was my ripple. If 2,000 or more years of the Judeo-Christian ethic didn't put racism away or any of the other things we dealt with, what kind of a fool would I be to think my little situation comedy was doing it? I'm thrilled with the discussions it caused, and what you just said, it thrills me. But I've yet to see the kind of change, except in the gay and lesbian issue.
Turn on TV now.
That's
right?
A giant move forward, and we had some part to play in that. I'm thrilled to remember, but we need that racially. In terms of what is occurring in our country, we need as big and positive a move as that.
Josh, thanks for the call to Radio Times. But do you think that comedy or satire allows either writers or perhaps an audience to think about these important issues that you care so much about, but you can do it and sort of laugh and not feel somehow assaulted by a message?
No, I think that's exactly right. There were a few people that were assaulted by the message. The people, the best story I have to illustrate that was when, before the show went on the air, when they did focus groups. And I would stand in the other opposite side of a glass, and I would watch 30, 40 people looking at the pilot. And, when people laugh together, really from the gut, they have a way of rising up an inch out of their chair and moving forward. So you see a wave. I would see a wave, and I would look at the dial, because they were turning a dial to say they liked it or hated it. And they turned it, negatively. They didn't like it, but they're roaring with laughter. which means they didn't want to be judging whether it was right or wrong for Archie to say the things he was saying. They wanted, or they wanted to be on record as saying wrong, but they were reacting. You know, that's the answer to that question the best way I can put it.
Well, this is a weird segue, but you have done so much in your life. You bought a copy of the U.S. Constitution.
The Declaration of Independence.
Yeah. And traveled around the country so people could look at it, so people could read it, see this important document.
Right. Well, I had we did a lot of other things along with it. I had a lot of help from a company called Home Depot, which put up a great deal of money to help it. The post office gave me a 16-wheeler to travel the exhibit, which David Rockwell, the architect, put together. We came here to Philadelphia and did a special before which we were taping in Constitution Hall a reading of the Declaration with 11 great stars. And we did 50 states.
Yeah. And that's Norman Lear, our guest today on Radio Times, author of this new memoir called Even This I Get to Experience. And you're listening to Radio Times here on WHYY. We've been talking a lot about your childhood and your career in television, but you also write very honestly about your three marriages. I mean, it sounds like you have found true love in the woman that you're married to now, but you write about Frances, what seems like a rather tumultuous relationship you had with her. And even at the very end of the book, you describe a 50th anniversary party for your sister and her husband. And you say about yourself that you'd finally grown past the superior attitude I held for so many years about my sister and her extended family. I'm sort of putting yourself on the spot here and calling yourself out.
I first have to say I'm so touched that you read that so carefully. And you're asking about that. It's the hardest thing in the world.
Yeah.
To write. Now, it wasn't that hard to write. Coming to the understanding that, you know, that my sister and her family, that what my sister, this is how I came to understand it. My sister, who never left Connecticut to speak of, who did everything she could to, this was a recognition I recognized writing the book, that she sang her heart out poorly because she couldn't sing. But she did it in hospitals and for sick and elderly people everywhere. And she did it all her life. And she did a lot of other things like that. Because I came to realize, because she hadn't ever realized that she couldn't really sing well enough to entertain it. But she did what I came to realize I was the fool.
Uh-huh.
That I wasn't seeing it as clearly as I needed to see it. That the difference between her brother, who made it in the big time, and Claire, who was singing for at hospitals and so forth, in the great scheme of the Creator's enterprise here, you couldn't get your fingers close enough to measure the difference between the two of us.
Well,
I loved her.
Well, Norman Lear, thank you so much. It's been such a pleasure. Thank you for joining us today on Radio Times. And we do want to close things out with the theme song from the Jeffersons, Movin' On Up. Let's give it a listen.